The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We are on iTunes under Writers on Writing. We are on Stitcher, other podcast platforms, hopefully coming to Amazon Podcasting soon. I am your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are still here 7 months into the pandemic, doing what we do each and every week, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, how they're working and focusing and thinking these days. Now I am doing it from my bedroom closet instead of a radio station, but I'm still grateful and happy to be doing it. Two things I'm giddy about today. One is welcoming back for the third time one of my favorite guests, Eric Weiner, and two is talking about one of my favorite subjects, philosophy. I may have shared at one time or another that I was a philosophy major in college, so if you ever want to know the true nature and essence of silence, you should announce to your parents that you're A, attending a private liberal arts college, and B, majoring in philosophy. So I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about that. Back to welcoming Eric. Eric Weiner is the award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and speaker. His prior books include The Geography of Bliss and The Geography of Genius, as well as Man Seeks God. He's been on the show with me both in 2008 and 2016 for his geography books. Those books have been translated into more than 20 languages. Eric is a former foreign correspondent for NPR and a reporter for the New York Times. He's a regular contributor to the Washington Post, BBC Travel. His latest is The Socrates Express, In Search of Life Lessons from Dead Philosophers. It's published by Avid Reader Press, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. It's going to drive a lot of our discussion today. Eric, welcome back.
Thanks, Marie. Happy to be here.
So as I was once again reading my favorite travel writer here, I was thinking this pandemic must be extra annoying for you, who's probably mostly stuck at home. I was just wondering what the mental situation is like for a travel lover right now.
I think at this point, I'm approaching the acceptance stage. I was in denial for quite a while, but you're right. I'm not doing much traveling. And at first, I really bristled and chafed at that. But at this point, I've come around to it and accepted it and realized it's not so bad to sit still for a while. It's giving me a chance to do some inner traveling and some deep reading and having conversations like this one.
It's a very philosophical perspective on the
occupational hazard.
Right. So you have been on three times, this is your third time, and I've never had the chance to talk to you sort of about your history into writing and your career path, you know, how that all came about, you know, if you were a philosophy major. Anyway, just tell me a little bit about your trajectory and when you knew you were going to be a writer and how this all came about.
Well, I was not a philosophy major, but I will, since you mentioned that, tell you a little story about Steve Martin, the comedian who did major in philosophy as an undergrad. And in one of his stand-up routines, he says, you know, if you major in any other subject, you instantly forget it the moment you graduate, except if you major in philosophy, then you retain just enough to screw you up for the rest of your life. So,
perfect.
Right. I thought as a philosophy major, you'd appreciate that.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
So my career trajectory in 42 seconds, let's put it that way. Majored in English literature, graduated with no real skills of any kind other than the ability to string together a sentence, a fierce sense of wanderlust, and naturally I decided to become a journalist. And that's what I did for a long time, first at the New York Times writing about aviation and flight, and then for most of my career at NPR, mainly as a foreign correspondent. And it was great. I mean, it was rewarding. I did get to see the world and tell stories about it. But I found it, after a while, a bit limiting in the sense that I was really focusing on the bad parts of the world, the ugliest bits, humanity at its worst. That's really what the job of a journalist, and especially a foreign correspondent, is. And I felt I couldn't be personal enough that, you know, I would go to, say, Afghanistan for a week or two and report, you know, a series of dispatches, and then friends back home would email me and say, so what was it really like in Afghanistan? So I made a shift to full-time nonfiction writing, trying to correct both of those, trying to see the world through a more positive light. And all my books have focused on the better parts of humanity, our better angels, whether it's happiness or spirituality, creativity, and now wisdom. And they're more personal. I can go somewhere and say whether I like the place or not, and meet people and say whether I like them or not. And I found this very liberating.
I also love that journalism, I would imagine, gave you the great skill of taking a really complicated situation or a complicated body of knowledge like philosophy and making it accessible to the average reader who picks it up.
Yes, and especially journalism as is practiced by NPR. There's something about writing a radio script, an NPR-style radio script, that forces you to get to the essence of whatever it is you're telling the story about, in a way that you're not, as a print journalist, forced to do, because the reader can always go back and say, what was that on page A1 or the previous, click and review. And, with the radio audience, you've got them and their attention for a limited amount of time, and you either hold their attention or you lose them. So I think working for NPR really helped me in two ways. It helped me, as I say, distill complex subjects to their essence, hopefully without oversimplifying, and also to write for the ear. That is something I still think I'm pretty good at.
There were some great, well, we'll get to that in a minute, but there were so many great lines in here. In addition to a ton of information, there was some really, really wonderful writing. So the last time we talked, which was January of 2016, when the world looked just a little bit different, at the end of the interview, you said you were embarking on your biggest and most ambitious project yet, but you wouldn't say what it was. So now we know. And, the relevance of this project of kind of going back to basics, back to wisdom, back to old thinkers and how wise they are now seems even more relevant in today's world than maybe in 2016. Let you introduce the book and what we can expect to find in it, and then we can kind of talk about what led you here.
Well, the book begins essentially with a hunger, a hunger that I had for wisdom. I just felt that, I've got this thing I carry around in my pocket all the time called an iPhone that gives me access to so much information and arguably so much knowledge too. With a swipe of my finger, I can access everything from, information about the ancient Egyptians up to theoretical physics and everything in between. And yet I felt this hunger for wisdom, for living the good life. I sort of end my book, The Geography of Bliss, this search around the world for happiness, with the conclusion, spoiler alert, that maybe happiness is not the be-all and end-all, the ultimate, that really maybe what we want is a meaningful life. And that's where wisdom comes into play. And, some of us find wisdom in religion, quite a few of us do. Others find it in social sciences, the latest psychology study, and that works for some people. But it just struck me that there is this source of wisdom out there that goes largely untapped for various reasons, which we can get into, but that source is philosophy, which, as comes from the ancient Greek philosophia, lover of wisdom or love of wisdom. Philosophy is the love of wisdom. A philosopher is one who loves wisdom. And that's how philosophy began a few thousand years ago. It lost its way in my mind and became a rather arcane, impractical in many ways, academic subject. But I'm hoping in some small way my book helps resurrect philosophy's original purpose, which was really about how to lead a richer, more meaningful life.
It's interesting. Well, you bring up the iPhone, and I do think that we were overwhelmed with the amount of information that we could carry around. And over time, it has obviously morphed into a lot of disinformation that we're exposed to. And I feel like that's really the inclination. That's where I was finding so much solace in this book is, getting back to basic principles of how do I know what I know? Back to Descartes, how can I know anything? Or a lot of these philosophers, how can I know anything? And I do feel like we've entered some sort of funhouse mirror situation of not knowing up from down with the amount of...
Well, I think we have a kind of data fetish at this point where we really think that more data, more information is going to solve our problems, make us happier, et cetera. And I really don't think that's the case. And, you know, there's such a thing as too much information of what my friend, the fellow writer David Shink calls data smog. You know, you're out in LA, you know about smog and smoke these days. And, you know, it can obscure your vision. You can have too much of it. Sherlock Holmes said, you know, what did he say? He said, let me paraphrase that, you know, what was important was obscured by the trivial, essentially, made with a layer of the trivial. And that's sort of where we find ourselves. We think if we can just get an internet, a broadband connection into every home and every school, that we'll be better off. You mentioned misinformation and disinformation. They're different. Neither one's good. You know, look with the virus, we have technology to help alleviate the virus in some ways, but we also have this technology that spreads mis and disinformation.
So I love the structure. So the book's broken down into a day, reflecting sort of the parts of our life, you know, young to old and dawn to dusk, and how philosophy applies in different ways at different times. It's funny that I studied philosophy in college because I feel like that almost was too young to come to philosophy. You know, I just didn't have an appreciation for it. I did, obviously.
I'm impressed that you studied it. And it's, you know, as I say in the book, you know, no one studies philosophy if their parents can help it. You know? Right. It's unfortunately seen, it's up there with art history and I guess English literature, you know, as you know, not the most useful degrees, which is a shame. But anyway, go ahead.
It is funny. My mother, when I said this, she was like, what about accounting? And I'm like, nah, they don't have accounting here. And she's like, what about accounting? And I was like, yeah, okay. So anyway, that's a whole nother topic. So talk a little bit about choosing this organization, the structuring it over the, you know, kind of a day, right. So life.
I wanted to, you know, bring philosophy back down to earth. So even though I was dealing with some fairly highfalutin ideas and some fairly inscrutable characters, my 14 philosophers, I wanted each chapter to be something visceral, simple, relatable. So each chapter is a how-to question, beginning with how to get out of bed, like Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor and Stoic philosopher. How to see, how to hear, like Schopenhauer, how to wonder, like Socrates. So simple, practical how-to questions, but arranged to mirror the arc of a day and the arc of a lifetime. Dawn, noon, dusk. And so some of the how-to questions that I wrestle with are the ones we wrestle with earlier in life, like how to see, how to walk. And some are questions of middle age, really, how to fight, how to be kind, how to appreciate the small things. And then there are questions, really, that we grapple with toward the sunset of our life, how to have no regrets, how to cope, how to grow old and even how to die, like Montaigne. So it reflects the arc of a life and the arc of a day.
This is getting back to the great skill that you got, I guess, as a journalist, because I would look at the amount of, well, the number of philosophers, the sheer number of, and the amount of information, and I'd just feel overwhelmed. So to even begin to wrestle these mostly men, a few women, to the ground and try and figure out how to make sense of all of that. I mean, it really sounds like you sat down and read all of Thoreau's diaries and read these long treatises.
I read a lot so that you don't have to. And I guess it gets back to what I said about, you know, overlooking. It was William James, the American philosopher and psychologist, who said that, you know, a large part of genius is knowing what to overlook. And with genius, but I had to overlook a lot, at least on the page in my book. In other words, if I were to try to write about all of Nietzsche's philosophy, that would fill up a whole book itself, if not several volumes. So I focused on his notion of eternal recurrence, which we can get to, but I focused on that. And for each chapter, I had to leave out a lot of what these philosophers wrote and thought about and hone in on that how-to question and keep coming back to it, which requires some discipline because you know, as you know, you start to research a book and you go off on this alleyway and this detour and this little ramble and amble down here and there. And I didn't want to fall into the trap that I feel that many philosophers and professors of philosophy fall into, which is, you know, the danger of trying to be comprehensive. A book that's about everything is really about nothing, and I wanted to avoid that.
It's a shame you weren't my philosophy professor in college, because it would have been way more fun and funny.
Yeah, I mean, philosophy can be funny. I mean, there's humor in Nietzsche and others, sometimes on purpose, sometimes not so much on purpose. And a lot of, you know, Steve Martin was a philosophy major, and now he's a comedian. So, yeah, there's no reason this subject can't be fun and funny.
Well, and you made them so human, you know, which is another thing that I missed in college. I just didn't realize, you know, they're real misanthropes. I mean, by and large, they're the guys that you'd cross the street to avoid. I mean, they're, one of them's masturbating in public, and they're...
Yes, that's not going to win you any fans. But he did that for a reason, right? For shock value, Diogenes. Mm-hmm. And Rousseau was exposing his buttocks in public, and Schopenhauer's talking to his poodle, and Nietzsche's being Nietzsche. And they all were human. We tend to put philosophers, like, you know, like up on pedestals as if they were saints, and that does them and us a disservice, because then they're just unapproachable. They're just, you know, the great Socrates. I mean, he was flawed and weird and ugly, you know, and I think by bringing them back down to earth, we can then encounter them and have a conversation with them.
Even Gandhi, like not in many ways, not a nice man at particular points of his life, right?
Father of a nation, but a lousy father to his children, a lousy mm-hmm. husband, as I think he would admit, had some weird ideas about sex, was wrong about some things, but was right about a lot, and was... fresh in his approach and his thinking and in his action. I mean, he was a philosopher as action hero figure. You know, I mean, he did things. That's, you know, that's true of a lot of them. They did do things, but not as much as Gandhi. And he was once asked by a journalist, you know, can you explain your philosophy to me? And that's when he basically said, my life is my message, that, you know, my philosophy is written in my actions. And that's a different way of looking at it. And one thing I wanted to do with this book was to get people to think about philosophy and philosophers differently, to make it a bigger tent. And some people I know would say, well, Gandhi wasn't a philosopher. He was a political leader. He was a spiritual figure. Well, I think he was a philosopher. And you know, I think he certainly was a lover of wisdom and put that love into action.
There are a couple of Eastern philosophers in the book, and I always, in my, you know, academic tradition, had divided them up between Eastern and Western philosophy. And I don't know if you found that in the much more amounts of research you did than I ever did.
Well, usually it's divided into Western and more Western philosophy.
Right.
To be honest. Right. You know, most compendiums of great philosophy and philosophers is all Western. It's all dead white men. And then, you know, there's maybe a separate course in the religion department at school on Eastern philosophy and religion. And it's certainly true that in the East, the line between philosophy and religion is blurred, if it exists at all. But there definitely is, you know, the West does not have a monopoly on wisdom by any means or on philosophy. So I include three in the book, Gandhi, as we mentioned, and Confucius, and a lesser known Japanese figure, a woman named Sei Shonagon. And yeah, I mean, I wanted it to be, you know, not for political correctness reasons, but just more because I'm sort of intellectually omnivorous, I wanted a big spectrum of thinkers.
Did you notice a difference or a similarity in their approaches, the Eastern thinkers versus the Western?
That's a good point. I mean, in the West, philosophy is more methodical. It became at some point in history more removed from the everyday world. The existentialists tried to bring it sort of back to the practical and everyday world. In the East, it never really left the practical side. I will say one thing that I found interesting is how much, particularly with, say, ancient Greek philosophy like Stoicism and Epicureanism, I started seeing similarities with Buddhism and with other Eastern religions. But the Buddha had the Four Noble Truths, and Epicurus had his fourfold cure. And it's not just a number four. There were similarities in their approach to suffering. The Buddha said that, you know, all life is suffering, and this suffering is because of our attachment. And Epicurus said something very similar. And they were living at, you know, Epicurus was living just a couple centuries after the Buddha had lived, and some of his acolytes, Epicuruses, had traveled to India and back. And I found it interesting that did Epicurus know of the Buddha's teachings, or did they both travel different roads and arrive at the same destination? But there's definitely similarities.
I kind of approach the book in two ways. One is a self-help book, because I think we all are. I'm in no more of a dark place than anybody else on the planet, you know, regardless of your politics. It's just a dark time. And there was so many pearls of wisdom. Wisdom, I guess, is the wrong. It's a play on wisdom.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, there were. I mean, it really became sort of a prescriptive guidebook, I think, on how to approach what we're going through here, on how to, A, get back to basic principles, as we were talking about earlier, how to just go outside and take a walk and remember that there are good things about the planet. There was just a lot of solid advice on how to survive, how to cope was a great chapter.
Yes, that one comes in particularly handy now. You know, of course, I wrote the vast majority of the book before the pandemic. We were able to add just a few lines into the introduction since. But in a way, that doesn't really matter, because we were all in a state of crisis before the pandemic. We just perhaps didn't realize it. And so the epigraph of my book, a little quote in the beginning, is from French philosopher Maurice Riesling, who says, "Sooner or later, life makes philosophers of us all." And that's where we find ourselves. Welcome to Sooner. But that was that time was going to come anyway, you know. You know, they say, what's that old expression? There are no atheists in foxholes, in trenches, right? And, you know, there are no non-philosophers in a pandemic. That, you know, even people who would say, well, I'm not really contemplative, I don't have a philosophical bone in my body. I guarantee you right now, those people are thinking some pretty philosophical thoughts about their lives, about whether they're heading in the right direction, revaluing and reevaluating what matters and what doesn't. We're all philosophers now.
So, as you say, a lot of this was written. Tell me the time frame this was written over.
It was written right up until the pandemic, basically.
But you'd started it before we talked last time.
I started it years ago. Each one of my projects. People ask me how long each one of my books take, and I will always say too long. It takes longer than I think, and it's several years. It's a lot of reading and a lot of travel, and then a lot of synthesis, and then a lot of writing and a lot of rewriting. So 3 or 4 years in the making.
Okay. Well, as long as we brought the Stoicism up, or the how to cope up, how to cope is addresses the Stoicism issue. There's a Stoicism camp. So tell me a little bit about how you found that camp and a little about it.
It's a little ad I saw in a Stoic publication. There are Stoic publications. Stoicism is enjoying something of a comeback. It was founded in 301 BC in ancient Athens by a guy named Zeno. And it's actually lately, even before the pandemic, become popular, particularly in Silicon Valley and places like that. And I think the appeal of Stoicism is summed up in the first line of a book called The Enchiridion, or Handbook, by a guy named Epictetus, ancient philosopher and teacher. And it's a very simple line. It says, some things are up to us and some things aren't, which sounds like incredibly obvious, but it's incredibly true. And we forget it. And we sort of go about our life, especially in a can-do country like ours, thinking that everything is up to us. And if we're not rich enough or thin enough or beautiful enough, it's because we're not trying hard enough, or we haven't found the right dermatologist yet, you know. And the Stoics say, actually, no, most of those outward externals are not up to you. You know, not even your health, really. Sure, you can go to the gym and exercise, but you might get hit by a bus on the way to the gym, or, you know, I don't mean to be facetious, but catch COVID at a gym. So much of the external world is not up to us, but what is up to us is our reaction to them. And much more, we have much more control for our reaction to events than we think, and much less control over externals. And that's Stoicism in a nutshell. There's a lot more to it, but that's basically it. That's the appeal. And why Stoic camp? Because, come on, it's called Stoic camp. The writer in me, if not the camper in the Stoic, said, you know, I'm not much of a camper, actually. I just thought it was kind of fun and funny. And it was in Wyoming. And I had traveled to a lot of the places. You know, each chapter takes place in a different location, or at least touches down in a different location before flying off to philosophy world. And it, you know, I had gone to Athens for Socrates and Frankfurt for Schopenhauer. But I thought, well, you know, if wisdom is portable, and I argue it is, then Stoic philosophy should work in the wilds of Wyoming as much as it does in ancient Rome.
I love that you got stuck there. That was the best part, is that, I mean, the irony was so wonderful.
I got stuck there and I had to cope. They say, and I always have to remind myself of this, that everything's material. And when things go wrong, that's material too. And when you don't have any material, that's your material. And it's true.
Well, and it's very helpful to take some of the pressure off of ourselves, that we feel like if we scream at other people enough, that we will get them to see our point of view. And just letting go of that control or illusion of control is very liberating. You know, I can only control my own thoughts. I can only control my reaction to what this person is saying. Somehow was a great reminder to me.
Right. And actually Gandhi, who was partly Stoic, I think, said, don't let other people walk through your mind with their dirty feet. So I think it's a great image. And yes, he basically argued, as the Stoics do, that we allow people to do that, that we let them live in our head rent free, and that we need to evict them now.
Well, and the chapter on, you know, appreciating the small things, I'm getting the chapter title wrong, you know.
That's pretty close, yeah. Appreciate the small things in life. That's and that's as channeled through Seishon again, who was a 10th century courtier in Kyoto to the empress, Teishi at the time, and wrote a weirdly wise or wisely weird book called The Pillow Book. I'm curious, had you heard of The Pillow Book before?
I had not. I hadn't even heard of her before, no.
Okay, no, see, that's good. That's good. I wanted to have philosophers where people have heard of some of them, but not all of them, and that's the case. So I was just checking. So yeah, she was very cool. And she writes, this book consists of a bunch of lists. It's mainly lists of things she finds endearing, things she finds delightful, things she finds annoying, things she finds, oh my God, I can't even, you know, and it's very opinionated. But her eye for the small was just remarkable.
I want to get back to this notion of lists, because I also read the book through the lens of writerly wisdom. You know, I read the book as a person hungry to get away from their iPhone, which is what led you to write it. And then I read it as somebody looking for writing advice. And if you read it through that lens, there was just a ton of it. I don't know if you thought about it through that lens, but, you know, this notion of making lists, I think, is a wonderful one when you're stuck with your writing project. There was something in there about brushing. Is that, she's the one that's talking about brushing?
Yeah, zuihitsu, which is a Japanese term, which means follow the brush. And the idea is, you know, thinking of Japanese or Chinese calligraphy, you know, you make a brush stroke and then you just make one, just wherever, and follow it, wherever it leads. And it's a philosophy of writing too, particularly of essays, that you just lay down a thought and you follow it and follow it. And you can always, you know, I think you're right. I hadn't thought of it as a sort of guide for writing, but that's certainly good advice for any writer. Is, I think it was Elmore Leonard who said that, you know, writing is like driving at night. No, and you can only see as far as your headlights, you know, maybe a couple feet in front of you, but you can drive 1,000 miles that way.
Right.
And that's sui hitsu in effect, you know, that's following the brush.
And just her idea of lists. I mean, I do think it's a nice idea when you get stuck, you can just make a list of your character attributes. You could make a list of philosophy your character would have followed, or, you know, whatever it is.
You're right. It's much easier actually to write, to start, I would say. I mean, a good list requires, it's definitely a skill that Shonigan displays expertly, but it's easier to write down a list of 5 things than to write 5 perfect paragraphs. Absolutely.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah.
Yeah.
You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Eric Weiner. The book is The Socrates Express, In Search of Life Lessons from Dead Philosophers. And the walking chapter, another great chapter for writers. I mean, there was some line in here about how the brain thinks the best at 3 miles an hour, which I hadn't focused on.
Something about walking in particular. You know, Dickens walked through the streets of London in the middle of the night when he was stuck on a novel or a plot twist or something, and he would put in 15 miles. And there's a long tradition of writing and walking, thinking and walking, because you're doing something. You're part of your brain is occupied by the act of walking. You're not just sitting at a desk staring at a blank screen or a blank page. But enough hard drive space is left open for you to come up with ideas. In a way, I think it sort of takes the pressure off your brain. I mean, the worst way to come up with a new idea is to just stare at a screen and wait for it to come to you.
There was a great image of some philosopher, I forget who it was, who had an inkwell at the top of his walking stick.
Thomas Hobbes had an inkwell designed into his walking stick, so when he's walking along the English countryside and an idea came to him, he could take out his fountain pen, dip it in his inkwell, and write it down. Yeah. Now we can just carry a notebook and a ballpoint pen, but yeah.
Or your damn iPhone and start dictating into it.
Well, I was going to, I purposely did not say the iPhone.
So many of those. So I just have to pause here and say, I don't understand how your mind holds all of it. You just have a remarkable memory, obviously, because you're just calling these people up and what they, that's the thing that I found hard about philosophy is I would read something and it'd be like trying to hold water. You know, it was an interesting idea, but it just kind of fall through my hands or I couldn't attach it to a name. But your recall for this is.
Because I'm writing about them. So I'm trying to, when you write about something, you own it in a way that you don't when you just read about it. I think that might be the difference. So when you write it, you own it. And that's one of the value and the values of writing is you come to know a subject in a way. You know, I don't have a terrific memory. I don't think it's the best memory in the world, but I've come to know these philosophers, their life story, and one or two aspects of their philosophy well, because I've lived with it for a few years. You would too, if you lived with it.
Well, maybe. I'll have to think about it. The other thing that I wanted to draw attention to for both the act of reading this like a writer and the act of reading it for somebody who's trying to figure out how to live their life better is this idea of curiosity versus wonder. And I was trying to put it into my own words to see if I understood it. So curiosity really sets out to answer a question, whereas wonder sort of sets out to explore an unanswerable question. Right? One allows you to ponder versus one allows you to investigate, do you think?
So I would say that, you know, curiosity is more restless and restive. And yes, curiosity is seeking to answer a question, which is good. That's definitely, curiosity is good. But wonder is kind of pre-curiosity in a way. You're not sure what question you want to answer. You know there's a question you want to ask and answer, but you're not yet sure what it is. And so you're in a pre-curiosity state. And, you know, we tend to use the words interchangeably, and there definitely is overlap. And I think instilling curiosity in, say, school children is great and terrific, and I wish our schools did more of that. But instilling a sense of wonder, I mean, don't you think the word has that? Wonder has the connotation of awe that curiosity doesn't necessarily have.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I do. And the reason that I bring it up is because I was thinking about this through, you know, again, through the writerly lens of whether it's more interesting to be a curious writer or a wondrous writer. And if you approach your work specifically trying to answer a question for yourself versus wondering about a question, if that would almost change the nature of the work itself, the way you approach it. No?
That's a good question. I mean, I think you have to have both. But I think a writer who has wonder in addition to curiosity, that it will come alive on the page, and that, you know, it will be, the words will be imbued with a deeper meaning, a more of an expansiveness. And part of, you know, wonder is the ability to change direction. Curiosity has that as well, but this, so we're, in a way, we're parsing words here, but that's what I did in my book, so it's fair. But I guess what I'm saying is, look, we talked earlier about my career trajectory starting as a journalist. And one thing that always bugged me about journalism, which, because it was a necessary part of the job, is I'd go into a story, an assignment, and I would have to have a pretty clear-cut idea of what the story was about before I did my first interview. I mean, that is just, you know, you're on a deadline of a day or two, you know, you read up on it, you've got to find out what you think the story is, and then you follow it, and then you're curious, you ask curious questions, but you're kind of committed to that track, and it's hard to change course and go hard left or hard right or do a 180 if you find out, no, it's not this at all, it's that. And the luxury of writing books is the luxury of time, which is the luxury of being able to change direction. I mean, just a brief example is, so I also would try to figure out what's the how-to question for each philosopher. And for Thoreau, I really got on the train for Concord, Massachusetts, thinking it's going to be how to be alone like Thoreau, or how to live simply like Thoreau. And I soon discovered he wasn't all that alone on Walden Pond. He had visitors. In fact, he had a chapter called Visitors. He wasn't living all that simply. I mean, more simply than you and I, but he would make the 20, 25 minute walk into town several days a week, have mom's home baked cookies, and have her do the laundry and maybe visit a local coffee shop, go to the post office, get his mail. So I started inquiring around town among Thoreauvians, what is Thoreau really about? And this one woman, Leslie Wilson, the curator of the special collections of the Concord Library, said without hesitation, it was how to see what he was about. And it just dawned on me. And then I realized, as I read his journals and I looked into it, that really is what he was about, how to see. And the rest, the so-called simple living and so-called solitude, was really about seeing more clearly. So that is, you know, I had to throw away my old map and pick up a new one.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because as we were talking about the curiosity versus wonder dichotomy, that's exactly kind of what I think I was trying to get at in my thoughts, is maybe a outlining novelist sits down with a question and is curious about it and sets out to answer it, versus a novelist or whatever, you know, essayist, just sets out sort of a bigger topic and lets themselves explore as opposed to answer or research or satisfy.
Yeah. I mean, I would say curiosity is a subset of wonder. You shouldn't skip over the wonder part to get to the curiosity part.
The other interesting, totally separate, but also interesting dichotomy was this attention versus concentration. Question. Another way that you interchange language that is totally opposite from each other. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Right. So this is, I should say this comes from the chapter on Simone Weil, a French, 20th century French philosopher, very unusual person in many ways. But she wrote a lot about attention and makes a sharp distinction between attention and concentration. And she thought concentration was kind of silly, actually, that you're if you're concentrating on something, you're narrowing your focus and you're narrowing your gaze and you're tensing your jaw, and there's something very muscular about concentration, like you're going to furrow your brow and focus on that one dot on the page or whatever it is. And she thought that was silly. She thought that attention was something quite different, something actually quite spiritual, and that attention is when you are, in fact, the opposite of concentrating, that you are completely open to what arrives to you. It's not a seeking out, but a waiting for something to arrive to you. Attention is more like listening. You know, when you listen and you like want to hear what's going on around you in your room or out in your backyard, you know, you have to get quiet and sort of take in all of the auditory surroundings and listen. And that's, I think for her, that was what attention was. It was hard to explain, but it's sort of an act that was a passive activity. I mean, it was much more passive than we think of concentration, but also very aware. A Buddhist, I guess, would say it was kind of the meditative state, a relaxed awareness. And she thought too often we would settle for concentration, which is, as I said, muscular and tensing. And she thought we missed a lot by concentrating as opposed to paying attention. Does that make sense?
It does. And I'm thinking that it really relates to your chapters on seeing Thoreau again and hearing, listening.
Yeah. I mean, you know what, there was definitely overlap and that notion of attention and, you know, and in talking about this book, sometimes people, interviewers will point out things I hadn't been aware of, but there definitely is a kind of this notion of acceptance and the importance of attention appears in every chapter. I mean, each one of these philosophers would probably say we have to pay more attention. I mean, that's from Socrates to Montaigne. I mean, by definition, they paid attention ideas into the world, or they wouldn't be philosophers. Attention's like the, I mean, that's the engine, right? I mean, that's what's driving everything. It's what drives writers too.
Right, right. Well, that's what I was getting at is, I think all of these techniques or insights are really, really good ways for writers to view the world, to be open, to be, and again, to not sit at their computer and stare at the blank screen, but to get out and be open and receptive and see things differently, listen to the people and things differently, right, to let things kind of come to them.
And to change your perspective, like Thoreau did, looking at Walden Pond, you know, through inverted, his inverted head, looking
right
upside down. And you know, there are all kinds of things we can do to see the world differently. You know, I mean, one definition of philosophy that I love is from the author and philosopher Daniel Klein, who said he was writing about Epicurus, but really it applies to all of them. He describes it as life-enhancing poetry. And I think that's how I view philosophy, as life-enhancing poetry. And I see the philosopher as much more akin to the novelist than the scientist. You know, I think if you're looking to philosophy for truth, well, you might be disappointed, especially when then philosophy is competing head to head with science and it's bound to lose, even though science was once part of philosophy, but nowadays it's bound to lose. But if you think of the philosopher is like a novelist, and you read a good novel and then you put it down, and for hours, days, weeks afterwards, the world seems a bit different. You see things differently, right? The novel stays with you. And I think the same is true of a good piece of philosophy, that you see the world a bit differently when you put the book down.
I always thought of it also as akin to poetry, because A, when you say philosophy or poetry, people run in the other direction because they're afraid. But B, you kind of have to look between the lines to feel it more than to experience it, to grapple with it, right? More than to learn it, right?
Right. They're both, I guess now that I think about it, both philosophy and poetry, in addition to being not highly paid professions, are not a body of knowledge, right? So like when you study, I took some poetry classes at school, and they're different in that, you might you'll read great poets, but you read them for inspiration. You're not trying to master a body of knowledge. And philosophy, at least as I define it, is also not mastering a body of knowledge. It's a how, not a what, right? You're learning how to think. And in poetry, I guess you're learning how to visualize, how to capture musicality of language. I mean, how to capture a sentiment, really. And And that's different from going to college and you know, learning history or psychology or physics, where it's just knowledge coming into your brain.
Right. Just a lot of factual memorization. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I loved the use of your daughter in this book because, you know, what's the saying about, you know, a battle plan will not survive contact with the enemy. And, you know, nothing will survive contact with the teenage daughter, I think is. And she became this great foil for you.
She brings me down to earth. And she's got this great sort of practical common sense side of her in a business sense that that I don't have. And yeah, she was my occasional foil and occasional travel companion as well.
She struck me as like this reverse Virgil or something. You know, you're trying to guide her, but she's guiding you. And, you know,
that's true. I mean, she was guiding me literally in Paris, where she speaks French and I don't, and she can operate the subway machinery and I couldn't. And she's also keeping me from going off on these metaphysical tangents and just, you know, reminding me that sometimes a train is just a train and sometimes, you know, a bridge is just a bridge and don't get too full of yourself.
I loved it. The chapter on how to grow old like Simone de Beauvoir was a particularly wonderful and poignant chapter for me because A, it's possible, it's coming to apply to me more and more in my life, and B, I was always a big Simone fan. So there was a lot of comfort and more wisdom in that chapter for me. And the one profession that I think you do get better at as you age is writing, unlike, you know, football or something. You get better as you get older yeah, with all this perspective, right? And
I think that's true. And there have been studies on this that mathematicians and poets, actually, I hate to say, do tend to peak earlier. But historians, writers, novelists do well later in life, yes.
She just had a lot of wonderful sort of insights. It sounds like she was kind of going into aging, raging against it. But
she was, and she wrote this long tome that not many people know about aging, that she wanted to do for old age, what she did for feminism, called The Coming of Age, and it ended up being a pretty dark take on aging for the most part, with some bright spots. And in my chapter, I focus on the bright spots. And I mean, one of the brightest spots, and I think this applies to writing, is she never stopped working. You know, she kept writing, kept working on her projects. She called them projects. And, you know, she wrote a series of short stories that was just panned by the critics, but she got back up and kept writing and stayed involved and stayed curious and stayed with the sense of wonder throughout her life.
I did like her emphasis on the importance of project, you know, as you age, and not hobbies, or there was another
right,
word that you
something
used, but
that's,
something
yeah,
meaty.
Because, right, not a pastime like, well, whatever it is, croquet, but something that kept you connected to society at large. Protesting, for instance. There's actually an interesting tradition of older people protesting because they have more to give and less to lose, right? I mean, it was a British philosopher, Bertrand Russell, who was arrested at something like age 85 for protesting the Vietnam War. The magistrate, you know, threw him and said, when he appeared before the magistrate said, you know, I'll let you go, you know, if you just promise to behave. And Russell said, I will not.
No. Yeah.
So there's something liberating about when you're older, you can get away with stuff like that.
There definitely is. And you made a point a couple of times, I can't remember in which chapters they were, but really another point for writers to enjoy the process over the result and, you know, to enjoy the act of writing over whether or not you're ever published. And, you know, I think there's such wisdom in that as well, you know, that you have to be in it for the daily enjoyment and not what comes out of it at the end.
Right, which is really tough to do. That is the wisdom of Albert Camus, of Gandhi, of the Bhagavad Gita, which all of them say basically put 100% effort into what you do, absolutely, and have 0% invested in the result.
This sort of came out of a question that was posed to you early in the book by a friend of yours. It sounded like you were a little frustrated with not having enough success, and she pressed into you of what does success look like?
Right. That was the question she asked. I was whining, which is in my nature and in my name, about something. You know, I wasn't getting on this list, or my book wasn't getting this attention, whatever it is. And she just stopped and looked at me and said, "What does success look like?" And I was just kind of stopped in my tracks. Because something about the way she phrased it too. What does success look like? You know, implied in that was, would you recognize it? Do you know what you're chasing? And I think, like all good questions, it was met with silence. You know you've asked a good question when the response is silence. And it just got me thinking, like, I need to answer that question. Because chances are it's always going to be a little bit more. And then, what is it really, if it's always a little bit more? And how much is enough? And what does it look like? It was a very Socratic question, actually, because Socrates, of course, always went around Athens questioning people's assumptions, and assumptions they don't even know they have. And that's what my friend Jennifer did. And I still ask myself that a lot when I feel like, oh, I'm not successful enough. Every writer feels this way, I ask myself the question, what does success look like?
That shuts
me up for a while.
Well, and that's the point. I think, that's the question we should all be asking ourselves all day long, right? What does success look like for us? The answer might change from today to tomorrow for the same person, but
exactly. Yeah.
But it's an important question to ask. Yeah. I'm overly familiar with the Socratic method because what else to do with a philosophy degree but go to law school? So there, you're just tortured with that there. So it's very frustrating. The Socratic method is very frustrating. It's exhausting.
It's supposed to be frustrating. I mean, don't forget Socrates was put to death for his method, essentially.
Right.
For annoying people, as I like to say. They came up with some other trumped up charges, but let's face it, he just went around Athens asking rich, powerful people annoying questions. That's just a recipe for hemlock, But I mean, I actually read a contemporary philosopher who said, and this is in my book too, he says, if you're not annoying other people, you're not a philosopher. And I read that, I thought, maybe I'm a philosopher after all.
I've been a philosopher my whole life.
Yes, my daughter reminds me I'm annoying every day. There you go.
And I didn't realize you taught. I went onto your website today, ericweinerbooks.com, and found out you teach. So that's...
This is new. So I as of a few years ago, I've been teaching once a year, and I started something called the Himalayan Writers Workshop with my friend James Hopkins. And we've done it 4 years now in Kathmandu, and sadly, this year it's not happening, but we hope to restart it next year. And I teach another course with my friend Jackie Leiden, fellow writer, called the Colton House Writers Workshop, which will be online this year in October. So, do you teach?
No. Okay. But I learn to go.
When James asked me to do it, I was like, I don't know if I'm a teacher. And I was surprised how much I enjoy it. In small doses, I don't think I'd want to do it full time, but it's using a different part of the brain, and it's there's less ego wrapped up than in writing, because you're teaching, you've got the audience there. Yeah. I don't know. I'm surprised at how much I've enjoyed it.
Is it only nonfiction?
It's nonfiction. It's usually an emphasis on travel writing, broadly defined. But I include writers like Italo Calvino in the course because his writing, though it's fiction, and I'm thinking of his book Invisible Cities, is great for firing the imagination. I don't think we have to draw such a hard line between the two genres.
Yeah. Is there a universal nugget that you like to share with students that you don't mind sharing with us?
I like the... one from Thomas Mann and one from Eric Weiner. First... from Thomas Mann is his definition of a writer. I don't know if you've heard this, is a writer is someone for whom writing is more difficult than it is for other people.
Perfect.
And that's like, I always, and people always go, oh, yeah, that's so, you must be a writer because it's difficult for you. I like that. And the nugget for me is don't write about what you know. That's usually the advice you're giving. Write about what you want to know. It gets back to that curiosity and that wonder. You write about what you want to know. So I wrote a book about philosophy, having set out to write it without knowing much about philosophy, but I wanted to know about it. And that's what drove me through every page.
Eric Weiner, this is always a pleasure. 4 years ago, I said, I can't wait for the next one. And I'll say that again. I can't wait for the next one. So congratulations.
Thank you. I've enjoyed our Socratic dialogue, if that's what this was, I think.
That was Eric Weiner. The book is The Socrates Express, In Search of Life Lessons from Dead Philosophers. You can find more information about Eric at his website, ericweinerbooks.com. That's W-E-I-N-E-R. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.